The Guardian.
David Grossman, the title of your new and already very acclaimed novel is To the End of the Land, and it has a literal meaning because your central characters embark on a long walk. They go walking in northern Israel for days, days upon days. It's something many Israelis do, but is there another meaning to this phrase, to the end of the land?
It's quite obvious, the other meaning, and this is the permanent subcurrent of fear that we feel in Israel, individuals and Israel as a collective. Our existence is, in a way, in danger, threatened. And there is this, echo of our past trauma, and the sense of the fragility of Israel. And this is something really to be asked. How come after so many years of independence, sovereignty, of having the most strong and efficient army in the Middle East, and still Israel feels so threatened, so questionable, so not guaranteed?
And so threatened that the land or the country itself could end. That could, no possibility is hovering over the title of the book.
Yeah. Ora, the main female protagonist, when she walks with Avram in the Galilee and they climb the Mount of Meron, which is a very impressive mountain, and she looks over all the wonderful landscape, the very generous landscape of the Galilee, and she tells him, isn't it always like that with Israel, that every encounter with it is also bidding farewell to it? And we know this doubleness, and we sense this subcurrent of fear regarding the future of Israel. And, I deeply feel that it is strongly connected with our chances of having peace. I deeply believe that only having peace will guarantee our future there. Maybe we can survive there, even without peace, for more years to come. But survival is not enough. I think we should use our enormous military might in order to allow us peace with everything that what peace can give us, and peace can give us life, which is much more richer and deeper than survival only.
It will give us much more security than domination, is one of the arguments you make. It's interesting you accept this notion that there is the threat, the existential threat, that finality and end of the land is a possibility. It's usually people on the right of the Israeli spectrum who conjure up the existential threat to Israel and say we are surrounded by enemies and we could it could be the end of our existence here at a moment's notice. But it sounds like you're accepting that premise, that Israel genuinely does live with that, despite its strength, existential danger.
Well, it's important to differentiate between the real concrete dangers and the echoes of our anxieties and our past trauma. And I try to do that. But it's hard to deny that there are existential dangers to Israel. The question is, how do you deal with them? People from the right, they say there is no chance. We shall always be doomed by kind of a divine decree that orders us to kill and to be killed. Peace is not possible. Our enemies never can be partners to any future agreement. I beg to differ. I think that we are not just passive victims of our situation and of our history and of our fears, and that we have the power and even the obligation to try to change everything in the situation and our approach towards the situation. Otherwise, we lost the war. I mean, if we stop believing in the option of peace, we already lost the war, and we made ourselves victims of this war. And since I think the very idea of Israel is that we shall never again be victims, and suddenly to see us with all this enormous military might again victims of our fears, this is bad. This is a bad sign. And still I believe that the vitality of Israel must push it towards another direction.
I want to get into many of those themes later, but let's talk about the book. And this central character, Aura, who dominates the book, it's her fears, her dreams, and her thoughts that are running all the way through the book from beginning to end. Some of the early critics of the book have said that she is your Madame Bovary or Anna Karenina.
She's my Aura.
She's your Aura. She's
my
your
Aura
creation.
in any sense.
She emerges on the page anyway, so fully formed, such a real and sort of textured person. Where did she come from?
Well, you know, people ask me how can a man write a woman in such a way, and I say I just surrender to her option in me. I just surrendered to the option of Aura. And when I was able to do it, you know, not to resist Aura, I just had to write it. She was there. And she has all, I mean, she's not a perfect person. And I think that's what makes her so real to people. This imperfectness of her, these inner contradictions and her moods and her impulsive, sometimes stupid reactions, and this mixture of banality and originality and all that, which, I mean, everyone knows people like her. She's a very Israeli character, and in a way I think she also reminds us of Israel in general.
I agree that she's very Israeli. Say how she reminds us of Israel in general.
Well, I think the way she navigates between fears and hopes, for example, between being a very moral, deeply moral person and can do and say the most outrageous, politically incorrect things, being you know, subject to her deepest fears and suspicion and racism even against the Arabs, and at the same time doing, you know, after her son Ofer did this unbearable thing in Hebron, or collaborated with something, you know, forgetting an old Palestinian in a huge refrigerator, and eventually he came out of this refrigerator, but he was heavily damaged.
Her son Ofer is a soldier in the Israeli army, and he's done army service in occupied territories.
And when she hears that, she freaks out. She cannot bear the thought that it happened to Ofer, this moral, sweet, tender, very attentive human being. And how can it be? And she starts taking bus number 18 for some days, almost without knowing what she is doing. She goes on the bus, and this was the bus that was most frequently exploded during the time of the suicide bombers in the 90s. And she goes on this bus, and she travels for an hour or 2 hours, and she goes down, not knowing what she was doing, in a way hoping to get exploded. You know, now this is a very radical act that she does. But you feel that it comes from a developed moral person. Yes, she feels that she has to pay for something. I do not share what she did, yes, but she has it. She has this option.
And when you say very Israeli in a way, that relationship of feeling horrified by what our wonderful young men and women are doing, holding both attitudes at once, knowing that things are going on in the occupied territories, and yet feeling these are our sons and daughters, these 18, 19-year-olds, and they're wonderful, young, moral people, and not putting the two together, in that sense, she would be typical of many Israeli parents, I suppose.
Yeah, and her need, her both needs, you know, both to protect her son and yet to criticize him and to make him alert of what he is doing, and at the same time having this fear that maybe she plant some hesitations within him that might prevent him from reacting towards danger when needed.
We should say something about the sort of premise of the book. It is that her son, who has actually completed his military service, volunteers to go back into active duty, and she is fearful for what might happen to him, and almost as a kind of superstitious way of preventing, the phrase uses magical thinking, she thinks, if I'm away and go on the walking holiday in the northern Israel and the Galil region that we were going to do together, then perhaps no harm can come to him. After all, I won't be here if the notifiers, the people who come and tell parents of the death of their children, if they come, there'll be nobody home. So that's the sort of premise for what happens. What struck me about the book is there is a kind of air of melancholy and of wistfulness that hovers over the book from the very beginning, of remembering of time that has passed, of loss, not just in terms of loss of life, but loss of childhood, of loss of those moments when a child is very young, that is in the book from the very beginning. And we're going to come to talk about what happened to you and your family. But you started the book in 2003, before yes. those events. And yet the book is absolutely infused, it seemed to me, with this kind of wistful melancholy, even from the very prologue, right at the beginning yeah. of the book, when we establish Aura and her, the two men in her life.
I think it has both. I mean, it has this melancholy melody in it of mourning something that has gone and passed, which is something that I felt then, even before everything happened, I felt towards Israel and towards the dream that we had, which was a lofty dream in my eyes. And it was also to mourn the hope that we had then. But it's also a book about the wholeness of life and everything life can suggest, and about the wholeness of life of a family and the drama of the family. These are things that fascinate me, ever they had. And of course, I started writing it in 2003, and in 2006, August 12, during the last hours of the War of Lebanon, we lost our son Uri, who was a fighter there in Lebanon. And I guess it had its impact, you know. I mean, it's also about the ending of a family as it used to be. But it is not something that is very specific for me only. So many thousands of people in Israel, they have experienced the same thing. And we raise up our children in this deep fear and in this feeling that they are only borrowed for us.
The thing that is sort of uncanny is that the very thing that powers Aura in the novel, this fear of the knock on the door to say that her son is lost, yeah. is then what happened to you midway through writing her story. And she had feared, had some of this magical thinking that somehow as long as she was away it couldn't happen. And you yourself had a similar relationship with the writing of the book. And the your own fears for what might happen to Uri, your son, in the army.
I had this magical thinking, but I knew it is magical thinking. I did not, and I do not believe that words can really protect life when you are in the heart of war. But it was a way to do what I can do in order to protect.
What we're referring to is this belief you had that maybe as long as you were writing this book, no harm would come to Uri.
Well, it's still very hard for me to talk about what I have felt back then. I can say now is that when I wrote, I had a feeling that I can be with him as much as I can. When I wrote, he was a soldier in the army, in the occupied territories, and I felt it is at least my duty to accompany him through writing and to do it. And maybe like Aura, you know, Aura, she goes and she tells her partner in this walk, Avram, the love of her life, who is not her husband, but very close to her in many ways. And she tells him the smallest details about Ofer, the little details, you know, the little facts, the little many acts and deeds and efforts that we do in order to accumulate one human being in this world.
The day he took his first steps as a baby.
Yeah, yeah. Everything, you know, all these domestic or familial miracles of creating a human being in this world. And she feels that by telling these facts, she, in a way, builds a kind of a wall around him, to envelop him, to protect him. This is the only thing she can do. She cannot do much more than that. But, you know, when existential danger hovers above the head of someone we love, we feel that all the effort we have invested in order to make him what he is, that it fades out, that suddenly nothing can help in front of the harshness, the brutality of war. And what she does, what Ora does, is to reinfuse life and strength and energy and protection into all these thousand small details. And this book is very much about the miracle of the family and about how, I will use the term, heroic it is to maintain a routine of a family in the midst of such unbearable reality like our reality.
Well, one thing that really struck me in the interview you gave to Rachel Cook of The Observer was you talked about how you returned to writing the book even after the Shiva period, the period of mourning, just 7 days, had passed after Uri's death, and you went back to the book. Just tell us a bit about how you were able to do that, and also the place that writing has actually in your own life, in your daily routine, in your own sort of composition of yourself as a human being.
For me, writing always was the way to find my place in the world and to understand the world. So many things I do not understand unless I write them. I mean, in a very stupid way, maybe, but I need to write them and to make them into a form of a story and to split the experience of life among different characters. And only then I can really envelope a situation and understand it. And of course, after what had happened, I think my instinctive choice was to go back to writing. Because the basic feeling after something like that happens to you is that you feel exiled from everything that you knew beforehand. Nothing is taken for granted. The most primal, basic things are dubious suddenly. And going back to writing was a way of recreating, you know, a home in this chaos. And I sat and I wrote and, you know, just the chutzpah even to insist on writing or finding the right, the correct word for the nuance of feeling that I wanted to describe, to insist on it and to know that it's so crazy to do it when the whole world falls apart around me. And yet when I found the word, there was this slight satisfaction of doing the right thing in the heart of this chaos. And then to be able to invent characters, to invent situations, to infuse life and passion and love and imagination into characters and into words even. That was a way of choosing life again. I'm in a different place today. It's 4 years, and I know deeply that writing was really one of the best instruments, I will use this terrible mechanical term, to find my place again.
I can see completely how that would work for you, who just is a writer, as a matter of just human identity, that is who you are. What about for the rest of your family? Has this book, reading it, which has such, as I said, strong parallels with what turned out to happen to your own family, has it been healing for them or painful for them, this book?
I think both. Like most of my books, by the way, but of course in this case deeper, even though, I mean, we must say it's not a book about my family.
No.
And it was not meant to be, and I insist on, you know, putting a separation between my life and my fiction, even though in this case the borders have been violated by reality, not by me. But you know, in all my books, when I wrote about people that recognize themselves in my book, it was both painful and comforting. You know, if you write about a person not from the outside, but you try to understand him or her from within, and really being him, disarm yourself from everything, and having this even generosity of being him, evocating him or her, in the end, it is very rewarding, both for the writer, for the person that I wrote about, and I believe also for the reader.
That leads me to something which I was interested about when you mentioned how Israeli she is. I mean, how have the Israeli reading public, who are lucky enough to get David Grossman books first, because you write obviously in Hebrew, your English is so good people might not realize that, but you write in Hebrew and their books are then translated.
You are very generous.
No, but it's true. Yeah. How have they responded? It's famously true that every Israeli family has a soldier in it. I mean, many of the people would have gone through what Aura has gone through, just the fear, I mean, for what will happen to their loved one. How have they responded to her and to this book?
I have no complaints. I think that the book was very enthusiastically welcomed and received, and both the readers and the reviewers reacted very good to it. But I want to say something else. I think that there is something in the book. First, the language, maybe. You know, in our situation, when reality is so harsh, you tend to reduce the language that you talk, that you describe with the situation, because no one wants to describe his nightmare with too a high resolution. And gradually the language reduces and becomes more simple and simplistic and even vulgar. And I insisted in this book to describe with nuances everything, both the fauna and the flora and the landscape of Israel, and characters and lovemaking and children raising and everything. I really wanted to regain the language that the situation has confiscated from me. And people reacted to it. And there was something liberating about it to people who read it in Hebrew. But the other thing is that the book is very political, but no party can say it is ours. And in a way, it allowed the Israelis, who for long are entrenched, everyone in his or her political position, and they are prisoners of this position. And by so doing, they negate and deny so many levels and dimensions of their being as human beings. They do not allow themselves to feel all kind of feelings that are contrary to their political position. And suddenly through this book, they were able, you know, to massage their political positions and
to break out of the narrow.
Yes, and to revitalize themselves as human beings trapped in a tragedy. And even feeling sympathy to the Palestinians, or guilt feelings towards the Palestinians, and acknowledging how terrible is our situation.
Let's just talk in our remaining minutes about Israel a little bit. It is a cliche that Israeli politicians always say that Israelis want peace, and of course they're desperately striving for it. Reading your book, you'd think that Israelis would actually kind of burn with a fever for peace, because it would be so terrible to live like this with the fear hanging over you all the time. And yet you read analysts about Israel who say, actually, Israelis are not hungering so desperately for peace. They found a status quo, a modus vivendi. Life is quite stable. You don't have to visit the occupied territories. They're not really in your face. You're not particularly aware of them. Yeah. The economy is doing fine. So what's the which of those is true? Are Israelis desperate for peace, or are they getting along without it?
I think neither is true. Israelis are not desperate for peace anymore, but they know that they cannot get along well in the current situation. But the real trouble for Israelis is that they do not believe in peace anymore, and they do not remember the alternative for war. And they develop this mentality of people who believe that this is the only possible reality that they will have ever. And even if there is peace, it will be violated immediately, and that we shall never have partners there. Now, this, in a way, mirrors the distortion of the Palestinian, the same distortion. You know, both sides, they do not believe now in the option of peace. More than that, they regard peace as a very dubious term, something that might be good for the naive Europeans, not for us. Our life is made of totally different material. And our life is the real life, so they think. And it is really hard, if not impossible, to advocate peace now.
But you've described there what Israelis and Palestinians feel about the possibility of peace, and fascinatingly saying that even the word has become debased a bit. But what about you? Do you think it's even possible now, or is it slipping ever further out of reach?
I think it is still possible. I don't know for how long. It is still possible because basically the majority of Israelis and Palestinians have voted already for the solution of two states. Very reluctantly, they don't like the idea, but they know this is the only possible, because the other option is either to continue the occupation, which is not an option, even the most fanatic Israelis, they understand it, or a binational state, which is also not a solution, because of the nature of these two peoples and the nature of the conflict and the fact that these two peoples deeply dislike each other, to say the least, and you cannot really see them functioning as citizens in the same political entity. It's really, this is a naive hallucination. They need a border between them in order to crystallize their identity as peoples. Part of their problem is that they never had real borders. And today, a nation needs border. I'm not talking about this terrible wall that only eternalizes suspicion and stereotypes and prejudices and hatred. Borders, like between two normal neighbors, with many gates to allow as many as possible trades and humans and ideas to commute. But we need border. We need walls to our home. Without walls, you don't have a home. You don't have a sense of home. You don't really have a healthy sense of identity. You have a kind of a paranoid identity. I don't like it. It generates only more and more wars. And I believe that still we are in a situation that we can reverse the distortion. We can start recover. Is it a realistic hope? I do not know. It depends on two people. I mean, on Benjamin Netanyahu and on Mahmoud Abbas. Will they be courageous enough? Will they be clever enough to realize what we are facing if they do not achieve a compromise? I don't know. Our Prime Minister Netanyahu has to decide this week in Washington whether he prefers or prioritizes the future of his coalition or the future of Israel. For me, the answer is very clear. I am not sure it is clear to him.
There'll be many people listening to this who will absolutely concur with everything you're saying, and they'll find themselves always doing that. And there is this view that you and your fellow Israeli writer Amos Oz are the Europeans' favourite Israelis, that they say that it's the exactly what Europeans would want to hear, very dovish and very open-minded, pluralistic and sort of humane form of Zionism. Are people like you and Oz, or are you now an endangered species in Israel? Do you speak for a ever-shrinking minority, or are there many like you?
First, I take it that you are sure that I'm not saying it so that the Europeans will like me. I say it because it is my life, it is my destiny. I take it very personally. I really want Israel to be, to exist, and to exist with security and with future, and to be able to explore all its amazing potential as a nation, as a society, and as a culture. It is something that is so primarily important for me. And this is why I say it. And believe me, if I thought that peace would jeopardize Israel even a little, I would not have advocated it. And as to your question, yes, of course, we are less and less people who support these opinions, of course, but it's very natural. When people are trapped in such situation, it is very hard for them to believe in the option of a solution, or to give trust or faith in their enemy of today. And I can say to myself, I also feel these waves of despair and of this rage and lack of hope regarding the nature of the two peoples involved in that, seeing their talent for self-destruction, their inner obstacles. And yet I believe that, you know, it is very important to insist on my arguments as a way, you know, just to keep this tunnel open in our mind, just to remind us that there is an alternative, that we cannot be the victims of our fears. I cannot afford myself this luxury of despair. I mean, it's my life, it's the life of people I love, and it's the life of the country that I love. It's not very simple, my love to my country, but I regard Israel as a very, not only as a nation, but as a very lofty idea, the idea of people coming back to their homeland after 2,000 years, and against all odds, creating what we have created there, you know, the language and the culture and democracy, with all the faults of this democracy, and agriculture and high tech, all this is a lofty idea, and it's worth fighting for.
David Grossman, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jonathan.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.